Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for the Roots and Roots Show with your host, Greg Rashid, bringing you history and music from the Black American diaspora. Greg and his guests' goal is to root the show's information in your psyche, providing you the roots to expand knowledge within your community. Now here's your host, Greg Rashid.
Well, I want to say good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you're listening to the program. This is Greg Rashid with another edition of the Root and Roots Show. And I know I haven't been on in a couple of weeks. I had to take a vacation to do my research and study because I have to, you know, study things so I can produce these great shows, and you folks really love it. And I'm just happy to be on here today and happy to, you know, just to say hi to all my friends and listeners that listen all over the world. You know, got new listeners now in Belgium, believe it or not. And I'm just happy to see that and happy that I hope that everyone out there is safe, that you're doing well. And, you know, I know a lot of you were hoping that, 2021 would be slower and just be different than 2020. But we see already it's going on with a big, big bang. And I just want to say, too, that I know a lot of you listen live, and I'm honored to do this show today on the anniversary birthday of Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. And if you're listening live, it's January 15th. But a lot of people listen at their leisure, at their convenience, and a lot of folks listen on Sundays, every Sunday at 3 p.m. Mountain Time on KUHS. DenverRadio.com, created by the one and only Henry Archuleta. And I want to say hi to all my friends out in the Colorado region. I lived there for 20 years, loved it there, hoping I would get back there to visit while I'm in the United States, but this pandemic has just slowed up my travel. But I'm just like, I don't know what to do. I'm just actually, I might be speechless, but I am just honored because I have loved the work and read the work of this amazing gentleman who's on the line right now for a number of years. And I have been waiting forever to get him on this program. And I'm just happy to have him on because we're going to talk about his latest book, but more importantly, what's going on in this world, especially how the book ties into what happened last week, January 6th, in Washington, D.C. And I'm just honored today to have on this program the legendary, the prolific, one of the best historians in the world, not in the United States, but in the world, who is just dedicated to his craft and work. And I'm talking about the one and only Dr. Gerald Horn, who is the professor of African-American history at the University of Houston. Are you there, Dr. Horn?
Yes, sir.
Oh, my God. I'm just so happy to have you on. I'm just like I'm just doing cartwheels in here. I got to keep cool. I got to keep real cool. But I love this book. I love all your books. But this one, the latest one, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. And this book, I mean, I don't know how you tied in so much in under less than 250 pages. You just tie in everything. And I just want to, you know, ask you, first of all, and by the way, the book is on Monthly Review Press. First of all, Dr. Horn, why did you decide, you already answered the book, but tell my listeners, why you decided to go to the 16th century and call it the long 16th century, and why you decided to go there to talk about the roots of, you know, white supremacy, because that's where it goes with the Europeans in particular.
Well, I've been on this historical journey, as your comments tend to suggest. And when I began this journey some decades ago, I was writing about the 20th century. But I felt that in order to understand the 20th century, I had to go back to the 19th century. And then in order to understand the 19th century, I had to go back to the 18th century, you know, and so on and so forth. So now I'm at the 16th century. I'm not sure if I'll go further back than that, but that's where I am right now. And certainly, I'm trying to understand how and why it was that England, this minor monarchy on the outskirts of Europe, came to rise to the point where now, here we are, people of African descent speaking their tongue while we're sitting here in North America. So I was trying to understand that story as well. But I have to say, I have to make a confession. Perhaps like many in your audience, my mental space has been dominated by January 6th. But I think that in some ways, to understand January 6th, it would be useful to understand what I'm talking about with regard to the 16th century. January 6th, among other things, was an expression of white supremacy. And I'm talking about the roots of white supremacy in the 16th century. This book also deals with settler colonialism, this project whereby people of European descent across class lines, from the rich to the not so rich, combine for their mutual advantage, not least plundering and pillaging the indigenous populations of the Americas and enslaving Africans. And certainly what you saw on January 6th was an expression of that same kind of class collaboration. That is to say, on behalf of a faux billionaire, Agent Orange, Mr. 45, Donald J. Trump, you had these people mostly of European descent ready to give up their lives for this faux billionaire. And when I saw these mostly men climbing the wall to enter the Capitol, I began to think about how they climb walls to invade West African villages in order to ensnare Africans, and how they climb walls to invade indigenous villages in North America in order to dispossess the indigenous population. But I also realized that since the 16th century, as my previous books have shown, we, the oppressed, have fought a heroic battle with our allies and comrades, and we've been able to push back to a certain degree against these pillagers and plunderers who you saw on January 6th, to the point where now they feel that it's time to turn back the clock. However, I would like to think that they have suffered an ignominious defeat on January 6th, although I am well aware that we are not out of the woods yet. We all know that there are demonstrations planned in 50 different state capitals on January 17th, demonstrations planned on Inauguration Day, January 20th. We all know what happened in Lansing, Michigan, just a few weeks ago when a plot was exposed whereby mostly Euro-American men once again planned to enter the state capitol in Lansing, blow it up in a made-for-television extravaganza, kidnap legislators, perhaps execute them, certainly planning to kidnap and put on trial the governor, Gretchen Whitmer, who had been in conflict with Agent Orange, and perhaps execute her as well. And plus, we all know that likewise, with regard to January 6th, not only did you have a number of veterans, military veterans, but you also had them armed. You also had them with bear spray and helmets and baseball bats and handcuffs. They had constructed a gallows on the grounds of the Capitol, according to press reports. Believe it or not, they were also looking to snag the vice president, since apparently he wasn't on board with the coup plot to not transfer power from the defeated Mr. Trump to the victor, Mr. Biden. So we barely dodged a bullet, quite literally, on January 6th. However, once again, we are not out of the woods yet.
Yeah, and anyone that believes that, you know, you're not looking at your history. You're not looking at what happened on January 6th. And listeners, you can join in the conversation at 563-999-3479, 563-999-3479. I'm talking with the one and only Dr. Gerald Horn. And this is a lesson for a lot of you out there. So if you don't have a real succinct question, just listen and learn. Because this brother is a national treasure. So really listen to what he's talking about. But the thing is, you know, why I wanted you on the program is because as I was looking at that on January 6th, I had your book right beside me. I've had your book for a number of months. I read it, and I said, wait a minute. This is too familiar. I mean, this is, you know, I got to see if I can reach the brother here, because what he's talking about in his book is what I'm looking at right in front of me right now. And, you know, it's just incredible how this whole thing, and a lot of people will still deny the issue. Some black folks will deny white supremacy. They will not. They won't say the word, but it's there. And I want you just to talk about that whole root of where, you know, where it starts with, you know, in Europe, the whole thing with the religions, how that ties in particularly the battle with the Ottomans, and how it just comes back to what you were talking about earlier, the whole January 6th.
Well, as I tell the story, the seeds of this phenomenon we now call white supremacy in many ways are planted at the end of the 11th century with the onset of the Crusades, when Western European Christendom felt the need to reclaim what they call the Holy Land, that is to say, the area surrounding Jerusalem and historic Palestine, from the Muslims. And that led to the so-called othering of the Muslims, that is to say, they are treated as some sort of alien grouping worthy of being vanquished. But in my telling the story, and to speed it up in the interest of time, a turning point comes in 1453 in this ongoing battle between Christians and Muslims, when the Ottoman Turks oust the Christians from rule in the city then known as Constantinople, now known as Istanbul. This induced existential hysteria and fear in Western European Christendom. And you can draw a straight line from that fear and hysteria to what transpires in 1492 when Columbus sails the ocean blue and encounters the Americas. Now, as you probably know, in 1492, you not only had Columbus sailing the ocean blue, that was the year when the Muslims who had been ruling Spain in the Iberian Peninsula for hundreds of years were finally ousted. And you also have the expulsion of the Spanish Jewish population as well. Although, as I tell the story, many of them wind up hitching a ride on Columbus's boats
right
to the Americas, where they are some of the first settlers. Another turning point in this story comes with the rise of Martin Luther and the breakaway Protestants, who then win a prize when King Henry VIII in London decides to join their cause. Of course, by joining their cause, he expropriates Catholic property in England, and that helps to infuriate Western European Christendom, particularly the Spanish. And what happens and what ensues is this series, this cycle of religious conflicts between Catholics and Protestants. But what happens with regard to the English, who are the underdog, as they say in London today, they wrongfoot the Spanish by moving away from religion as an axis of society to race. In other words, in order to become a settler in the Americas under the Spanish flag, you have to be Catholic, which is one of the reasons why you had black conquistadors, because they could profess Catholicism and join in
right
the looting and plundering of the indigenous population. England, which was the feisty underdog, there probably weren't enough Protestants to go around, so they moved to pan-Europeanism, and that helps them to reconcile with Irish Catholics, Scottish Catholics, helps them to co-opt other Protestants, for example, the French Huguenots, who are Protestants, and that turns out to be the winning ticket. And that helps to explain how and why it is that even though Spain had established a colony in St. Augustine, Florida, of course, St. Augustine builds itself as the oldest urban area in North America, in the present-day United States, and of course, from the inception, Spanish Florida, St. Augustine, Florida, had enslaved Africans present. However, when Spain tried to expand from its base in St. Augustine, Florida, inevitably they were blocked by alliances between combative indigenous populations and their African allies, which then allows London to, or the English, to sail into what they call Virginia, supposedly named after the Virgin Queen, supposed Virgin Queen, Queen Elizabeth,
right.
In 1607. Spain, from its perch in Florida, wanted to intervene, but it could not because it was too busy tied down fighting the Africans and the indigenous population. And that's one of the reasons why we're sitting here in North America, at least I'm in North America, speaking English.
Because we could easily, as you say in the book, you could easily be speaking Spanish now. It's just, you know, it's just amazing. Oh. A lot of folks don't realize that.
Or you could be speaking Turkish, because in many
ways, that is true.
Turks were the major power, at least in Europe. And of course, they were, it's interesting, the Ottoman Turks were also enslaving Africans, but they were equal opportunity enslavers. Recall the savage who attacked the Muslims in New Zealand a year or two ago. Before he did that, he had toured various areas of Eastern Europe, where the Ottoman Turks had enslaved Europeans, like in the former Yugoslavia, the Balkans, Bosnia,
right.
For example, Albania, where there's still Kosovo, still substantial Muslim populations in the heart of Europe. And he was seeking to wreak vengeance against these Muslims in New Zealand because he blamed them for what the Ottoman Turks had done in Europe, enslaving Europeans. And so it was the English, the underdog, who began to focus like a laser beam on enslaving Africans. Even the Spanish, they, of course, enslaved the indigenous population. So did the English, too, to a certain degree. But the Spanish also, from their colony in what they call the Philippines, named after King Felipe, still called the Philippines for whatever reason, they began to drag what they call Filipinos across the Pacific into their colony in Mexico. They did that for decades, for example. So, interestingly enough, it was the underdog that began to concentrate and focus heavily on enslaving Africans.
And that's really amazing. And listeners, you can join in the conversation, but I hope you're listening and learning. 563-999-3479. I'm talking to Dr. Gerald Horn, author of the new book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. And it's on Monthly Review Press out of New York. Now, Dr. Horn, I mean, I'm just, you know, reading this book. I'm just, you know, and I like the fact that, you don't want to, like, talk about the whole, you know, get the whole book, talk about the whole book so nobody will go out there and buy it. But I was really impressed how at the end you get into environmentalism.
Oh, yeah.
Because it kind of, it just threw me for, and I don't want to say for a loop, but it was needed. And I hadn't even thought about it in the context of white supremacy and what the settlers had done. But talk a little bit about why you had that at the end on the last chapter.
Well, climate change, which we're enduring now, is an elongated process. As the detractors of this idea that the climate of the planet is changing like to point out, for centuries you've had various forms of climate change. But what they neglect is the next step, which is that sometimes when you've had a kind of ice age, it has prepared the way for invaders. And that was the case at the end of the 16th century with regard to the Europeans who were able to take advantage of what was called a little ice age. I should also say, in terms of explaining the advantage that the Europeans were able to gain, part of it has to do with the fact that if you look at what is called Great Britain today, there was fearsome warfare for centuries between and amongst the English and the Irish and the Scots and the Welsh. And as a result, by fighting each other, they were able to master various forms of warfare. They were able to develop arms industries that to a degree could overwhelm other populations who were not as bellicose and not as involved in developing the engineering of and the engineering and the merchandising of death. And so what happens is that in some ways what transpires is that the Europeans move from fighting and quarreling with each other, either on a religious basis, for example, Catholic versus Protestant, or on an ethnic basis, for example, English versus Irish, or what
right.
comes to be called British versus German, and German versus Pole, and Pole versus Russian, and Croat versus Serb, and Northern Italian versus Southern Italian. I mean, it's an endless list. All of a sudden, when they cross the Atlantic, magically they're transformed into being called white, so-called. And that's the kind of identity politics that's militarized and basically involves a kind of trans-class unity for the interests of mutual plundering and pillaging of others not so designated as, quote, white, unquote. And in many ways, in a nutshell, that's the story of what has happened in the Americas for the past half millennium.
And that's a key point. It's in your book and in your other books, that whole thing about when these people who are European become white. Because they're not calling, prior to this, they're not calling themselves white. It's like you said, they're just calling themselves Irish, English, whatever. And that's something that a lot of folks, and unfortunately, it's not taught in the schools. You know, you don't really see it in the media or anywhere. You know, and your books should be required reading in every school around the world, not just in the U.S., you know, because it's very important, because that's a key element. And that's what I've gotten out of the majority of your books I've read and know about in your lectures, that when that, you know, when these folks become white and why they use it as a weapon, and that's something that is very important. And I'm just glad that you, in all your books, that you elaborate on that. I just want to thank you for that.
Well, 2 points. One is, thus far I've been talking about the branches of Christendom, Catholic versus Protestant. I've made reference
right.
to the Muslims. But I should also bring in the Jewish question as well, because interestingly enough, at the end of the 13th century, you had the English who expelled the Jewish population and sent them fleeing oftentimes to Turkey. And then, as I noted, in 1492, you had the Spanish who expelled the Jewish population. But interestingly enough, the underdog Londoner, the English, they engaged in a historic compromise because they were fighting a more formidable foe when it comes to Catholic Spain, who, of course, had alienated their Jewish population by expelling them. The English did a 180-degree reversal and began recruiting those who were Jewish into their ranks, and so did the Dutch, for example, because the Dutch play a key role in this story. Because if we had been talking, say, in 1599, to soon say that in 2021, the leading power would be the Dutch, not necessarily the English. But in some ways, what happened is that, as I say in the book, the English are willing to ally with the Dutch and fight the Spanish to the last Dutchman, so to speak. I mean, they sort of used and abused the Dutch. And the Dutch
right.
also, of course, helped to incorporate the Jewish population into their ranks. And that's also, you know, I continue the story, of course, in my book on the 17th century, talking about how that in the 1650s, on 1640s, excuse me, when you had the Dutch who had temporarily taken over Brazil from the Portuguese. But the Portuguese came roaring back and ousted the Dutch, and the Jewish entrepreneurs who were in Brazil under the Dutch flag felt the need to flee them, it was in the 1650s that the English had overthrown Spanish rule in Jamaica, and the Jewish population in Brazil fled to Jamaica. They brought the skill that they had in helping to produce sugar through enslaved African labor. And, of course, that leads to the sugar boom in the Caribbean and the ability of the English to produce sugar in Jamaica and other Barbados and other islands. Sugar, of course, was seen not only as a way to sweeten your tea and coffee, but as a kind of miracle drug as well. It brought in tremendous profits, allowing London to build a bigger navy and build bigger ships, whereby you could go into Africa and snare more Africans and enslave them, bringing them across the Atlantic to work for free in the sugar fields, producing more wealth in a circle devoid of virtue. And in some ways, we are an adjunct of that entire unlamented process.
That's correct. And listeners, you can join the conversation, 563-999-3479, talking to the legendary Dr. Gerald Horn. Now, Dr. Horn, you know, there's something, it's not in your book, but it's in your books in a sense. I want, do you think that the U.S. is actually still controlled in a sense by the British? And why I say this is because why is there such an emphasis in always knowing about the kingdom, or what the queen is doing, or what the family, the royal, so-called royal family of England is doing? When you have royalty throughout the world, you have monarchies throughout the world, why the fascination in this one and being constantly pushed on people?
Well, I would say it's a product of the fact that the rebels led by George Washington, they broke away from London's rule, and they speak the language of London. And I mean, like myself, every morning I read the Financial Times of London in the hard edition. I read the Guardian of London online. I mean, it's mostly because of the language question. I find it easier to read English than any other language that I'm familiar with.
Right.
And so I think that leads to a bond. And to bring it up to 2021, I think that you can also connect this to January 6th and also December 31st, because on December 31st, 2020, Britain broke away from the European Union, Brexit, as it's called.
Right.
And I think it's going to weaken Britain. In fact, I think it leads to a sort of reversal of fortune, because I think Britain basically is going to become sort of a neo-colony of the United States. As a result of breaking away from the European Union. At the same time, when Britain removes itself from the European Union, it removes Washington's major agent in the higher councils of the EU, strengthening the hand of France, which over the decades has been willing to buck the domination of Washington. And you also saw this when just before the new year, the European Union, at French urging, signed a massive investment deal with the People's Republic of China over the objections of both Trump and Biden, both of whom would like to launch a new Cold War against China. And, of course, they would need the European Union to join in. The European Union doesn't join in. It doesn't look like they will. It's likely that Japan nor India will join in as well. And so that probably means that there is another reversal of fortune, China in the passing lane. And in some ways, it reminds me of what happened in the 1500s when Turkey cut this deal with the English against Catholic Spain. It did not envision that it was cutting a deal with the country, England, then Britain, that would become a major superpower. And in fact, by the 19th century, Turkey, in many ways, is an adjunct of London. And so in the 1970s, we're marking the 1971 is the 50th anniversary of Henry Kissinger going to China to broker an anti-Soviet deal with the People's Republic of China. Kissinger did not necessarily envision that weak country at the time, China, would turn into this juggernaut, not least because of massive foreign direct investment by U.S. corporations, shipping jobs across the Pacific, by the way, because of the cheap labor. But now it's created this juggernaut. I mean, just to cite one statistic amongst many, China basically has endured about 4,000 plus deaths as a result of coronavirus and COVID-19. The United States in one day will have 4,000 deaths, and of course, is now reaching the 400,000 mark. At the same time, China's economic growth rate for this year will be about 8%. The United States will be lucky to recover from COVID-19 by July, if the United States is lucky. So you see that when you're looking at history, you're not only looking at what happened in the past, you're really looking at the roots of the present. And in order to understand the present, you really have to understand the past. It's just like when you go to the doctor.
That's correct.
The doctor often takes a medical history, not necessarily because the doctor is looking for gossip. They feel that they need your medical history in order to make a diagnosis and a treatment plan. And likewise, if you're trying to make a diagnosis of the present maladies of this society or the world for that matter, so you can develop a treatment plan, it would be quite useful if you were familiar with history.
And that's why I wanted to have you on today because, you know, like I said, I had the book beside me as I was looking at what was going on last week on January 6th. I said, you know, it's nothing unfortunately has changed. And you got to know your history. But Dr. Horn, before we conclude, I just was wondering, what would you say to, you know, someone as far as to get, you know, what would your message be to someone who is like, let's say, in the BLM movement or, you know, who really, you know, they want to understand the history. What do you say to them? And what do you say to them, someone who should be reading your book, all your books, but this one in particular? What do you want them to get out of it?
I want them to understand how we got to the brink of catastrophe, which is where we are now. Here we are. We don't know what's going to happen in this country. There's going to be a right-wing coup and murderous takeover with the liquidation of our leadership, even the liquidation of mainstream historians. Who is to say? How did we reach this catastrophe? It seems to me that if we're to figure out how to get out of this deep hole in which we find ourselves, we're going to have to try to understand the path and the route that delivered us to the point and the brink of catastrophe. And certainly with regard to younger people, I would encourage them to study languages. I would encourage BLM activists to keep up with what's going on in Geneva, the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, where they're investigating human rights violations with regard to police terror against our community. And the best case scenario would be severe sanctions imposed on the United States coming out of the United Nations Human Rights Council. So those are just a few of the lessons I would like to leave with your audience.
And those are perfect. I hope my audience heard that. That is so perfect. One more thing before we conclude this. What do you say to folks who are like out there, you know, after the election in November, that were out in the streets having a party and who are jumping cartwheels as we speak, thinking that a new dawn will appear starting on January 20th?
Well, I understand the sentiment. I mean, after all, Agent Orange has been a disaster, but I understand your sentiment as well, because as I said, we're not out of the woods yet. I mean, we're entering a kind of science fiction era.
Right.
All bets are off.
That's right.
You know, what we thought was stable is proving to be as unstable as nitroglycerin. So people need to buckle their seat belts, because it's going to be a bumpy ride from this day forward.
That's right. And, all the books you've written, would you ever imagine that you could write a book about what has gone on in the whole Agent Orange era? Could you even imagine?
Oh, sure.
I mean, just writing a fiction. I'm talking about a fiction novel.
Oh, sure. As a matter of fact, here's a tip I've been passing out. for someone who wants to write a screenplay about January 6th. According to the Washington Post, the evil, diabolical genius behind January 6th is a black American who goes by the name of Ali Alexander.
Oh, Ali.
Formerly
yeah.
Named
one of his
Ali
aliases.
Akbar.
Right. Yeah, one of his aliases.
He sort of looks like Sammy Davis Jr. But, you know, it would be, if Chad Boseman were still alive, I'd like to see Chad Boseman in that role. But that plot, it seems to me, is certainly worthy of dramatization.
It certainly is. And he doesn't say, he says he's from Texas. He says he's black, but he's also, he says sometimes that he was a Muslim, that he's Arab, but then he says he isn't. And you really wonder what he is as far as who's paying him. But that's another
story.
That's
a good question. That's another story altogether.
Yeah, that's a whole thing. And he's been, you know, he's someone that's, I guess, 4 years ago, he was convicted of some felony charges. There's been caught stealing things, a little bit of everything. And he's gone from that into what he is right now. But that's a story in itself, as you were saying. But Dr. Horn, I just want to thank you. I could keep you on here all day, but I know you got to go, and I just really appreciate it. And if anyone wants to get a hold of you as far as your email, Facebook, whatever you may be on, tell, you know, any email, anything you can give to my listeners, please do that.
Well, I'm on Facebook. You can find me there. I would also like to point people to my YouTube videos, of which there are many. With regard to direct contact, you can email me at ghorne, ghorne, at uh.edu.
Okay. And what, I know you're having a tough time now just because you're a prolific researcher. And have you been able to get out? Have you been just using the internet now for research or?
Well, my research program is sort of suspended right now. I have a
yeah.
couple projects that I envision finishing this year, but I've started other projects just by reading dissertations online, master's theses online, books that have lost their copyright online. And so, you know, I've adjusted and adapted, but certainly I've been slowed down.
Right. That's amazing. But I just want to thank you for coming on today. Hope to get you back on again. Just thank you again, Dr. Horn. I love all your work and just love everything you've done. You are truly an amazing treasure to this world. Thank you so much. You be safe. Look forward to having you back on again and talking to you and maybe meeting you in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. You take care, buddy. I'll see you later. And again, that was Dr. Gerald Horn, just amazing scholar, just an activist, you name it. I mean, we just even touched on this book. I mean, but get the book. I mean, I just have to say, just get this book. The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. It's on Monthly Review Press out of New York. And get some of his other books, too. I mean, it's just, because they don't, like I said, I just wish that every school, everyone had a copy of at least one of his books in their homes, in the schools, so you can really learn some true history. And again, that was this Dr. Gerald Horn. And I'm going to play right now because it's I think it's apropos to what's been going on, what Dr. Horn was talking about. And I'm going to play, and I've played this song a number of times, but I think it's appropriate now. I'm going to go back to the early 50s, Big Bill Brunzi. And if you're black, get back. So let's hear that on the Root and Root Show.
This little song that I'm singing about, people you know it's true. If you're black and gotta work for a living now, that's what they would say to you. They say, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I was in a place one night, they was all having fun. They was all buying beer and wine, but they would not sell me none. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, you'd stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. Me at office, the number that I got in line. They called everybody's number, but they never did call mine. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. Me and a man is working side by side. This is what it meant. They was paying him $1 an hour, and they was paying me 50 cents. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I hope built this country, and I fought for it too. Now guess that you can see what a black man have to do. He says, if you was white, she's all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I hope win sweet victory with my little plying hole. Now I want you to tell me, brother, what you're gonna do about the old Jim Crow. Now if you're white, she's all right. If you're brown, stick around. But if you're black, oh brother, get back, get back.